this is Pearl Lamb Podcast. I'm here in London sitting with Anders Petersen, and I will let Anders to introduce himself.
Well, thanks, Pearl. Thanks for inviting me to this. I mean, we met a year ago.
More than a year ago, more than a year, right?
Yeah, it was maybe a year and a half.
Yeah, a year and a half ago.
And
no, 2 years ago.
Was it already 2 years? Okay.
Was it 2 years ago?
It might have been.
Because when did we have... Never mind, we met each other at a panel.
I started to listen to your podcast after that, so it's an honor to be here today. So I'm the founder and CEO of R-Tactic. I founded the company 25 years ago. It's a company that purely focusing on research, particularly around the art market, but art market in a sort of a broader sense, the art ecosystem, not only looking at the commercial, but also looking at museums, we're looking at philanthropy, patronage. And I guess I've had the kind of honor, really, to see how the market has evolved over the last 25 years. You have seen it also.
But Anders, you were a banker before. Well, JP Morgan banker, and yeah. How would from a banker and then started to find this company at that? I mean, there isn't that sort of company.
No, I think it's quite unique. The company which is purely focusing on what we're doing. I think the transition from banking to art wasn't as abrupt and brutal as it sounds like. I think it's...
I had a
passion for art, contemporary art particularly. So I came to London during the 90s, which was the kind of the growth and
the beginning
of the YBA.
Of everything. Yeah.
And I found it really exciting, and I didn't really know much about it, but I had the pleasure of being surrounded and the media and everything was kind of doing more attention to art. And I thought, this is really interesting. So I was a viewer, not a collector, not a buyer. I was simply enjoying the art scene. I think the investment or the investment banking world I was in probably came to a point where I saw, okay, if I continue on this path, there will be one motivation, and that will be money that's going to drive
me. Of course.
And I didn't really, I was still in my 30s, so I wasn't sort of taken by that. And I thought, okay, well, if I don't make a change now, I'm never going to make it. So I, in 2001, which I actually my 30th birthday, I decided, okay, I'm going to do something else.
That's very courageous from a very well-paid investment banker's salary.
Yeah,
jump into a completely new enterprise.
Yeah, it was actually, maybe sounds courageous. I probably was naive. I thought this is, I had this great idea that because I was obviously working a lot with information in the financial space. I thought, well, why isn't the art world having these kind of things? And I thought naively that this is exactly what they needed, but found out quite quickly that the art world didn't really need that information at all. So it took me a good decade to, I would say, to kind of build the company. I started actually, which is one of the core things he's still doing, is education. So I started to teach at various educational institutions. Mm-hmm. So I've been at Sotheby's Institute for now almost more than 20 years doing lecturing. And that is where I see a passion sometimes is to kind of, it's really the teaching and feeling that your knowledge and your research somehow can actually influence someone in terms of either initiating a career or setting them on a path to something they feel passionate about. So but then obviously, as we maybe going to come back to, the industry has changed radically over the last 25 years.
This 25 years is very different.
Very different.
From the 20th century.
Exactly.
25 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so recently, since I arrived in London, and everyone is in the art world is getting very nervous about freeze, about the market.
Yeah.
Everybody, galleries I know, they said, oh my God, I don't know how to break even during freeze. So what do you think?
Yeah, I live here. And I think the art fairs is, you're probably in a better position actually than I am sometimes to actually gauge what actually happens in the art fair. I think there is obviously from a, we live and breathe data, in various forms, whether it's talking to people, etc., or looking at transactions in terms of auctions. I think one of the hard things with the fairs is to kind of get a proper sense of what's going on. But I think you can start to see, obviously, the ripple effects that the downturn that we had since 2022 is now starting to have a real impact on the art market, and every single player in the market, whether you're from a gallery to museums, public, private sector. And it almost feels like a sort of an existential crisis in a sense. We are dealing with the old models, the same thing that we've done pretty much for the last at least 25 years, something longer. When you were a gallerist, you know how to run a gallery. That model, you know, you could argue, is that fit for purpose in the 21st century? And is it fit for the kind of shocks that the art world has gone through? And we had a pandemic, we've had a geopolitical situation, we have an economic situation, which none of these are very conducive to, I guess, encourage people to buy something that isn't a necessity. It's a sort of a desire to reset that there. I think among certain parts of the ecosystem, talking particularly to a lot of younger galleries, are finding it difficult to compete in the current landscape. They feel that they need to be part of a model that was created in terms of thinking about art fairs, when you mentioned in terms of your participation in art fairs.
Let's first talk about Frieze versus Art Basel Paris.
Yeah.
And it seems that most of the Americans, they are no longer going to Basel.
Mm-hmm.
They're no longer coming to London. They only focus in Paris.
Mm.
I mean, do you hear about that?
Yeah, no. I, again, sort of more on the kind of grapevine, where you had people that normally would come to Frieze, and we would have normally met them during this week, said that we're not coming this year, we're going to Paris instead. So yes. I think there's some of them have not been to Paris, the Art Basel, yet. So they're doing this as a saying, okay, if you're going to choose, we will choose Paris this year to see what that looks like. I think there's maybe a general fatigue, you know, in terms of traveling and seeing all these fairs.
Because all the Americans, it seems that they only want to visit London once.
Yeah.
I mean, and visit Europe once. Yeah. And then obviously they drop Basel because there's not enough restaurant, food, things to do. So they chose Paris. But on another thing, on the gallery side, some of the galleries was telling me that the most money they ever made is in Basel.
Mm.
Since it moved to, now people are not, you know, most of these people are not going visiting Basel, they're visiting Paris. Mm. But in Paris, there's so many things to do.
Yeah.
So they only visit the art fair just one day, the opening day, and they never return.
Yeah.
So the profit, the general profit that they expected to make from and from Basel does not translate to Paris.
Mm.
Do you hear about that?
I haven't actually heard that particular thing, but it doesn't surprise me. I think it comes a little bit back to what I said in terms of the model of art fairs are, I think, you know, what's
There's
happening.
So many art fairs.
So many art fairs and the cost associated with art fairs these days. I mean, it's not simply the booth, but, you know, shipping costs.
Your staff.
Yeah. Which means, I think, for a lot of for galleries, you will have to play in a kind of a Premier League of the art market in order to afford that. And I think this is maybe one of the issues that we're facing, is that everyone aspires to play by the rule book of the old rule book, which is sort of you enter into certain fairs. The certain fairs gives you then access to certain collectors. But the impossibility, I think, for a lot of galleries now to break into that just purely for financial reasons are so big, so that you're ending up with a slightly sort of, I guess, an art world that becomes very conformed to a certain number of artists, certain number of galleries, and very limited in the new things that are happening on the fringes. So, you know, I know most fairs will have a, you know, a fringe type of where they invite younger galleries, but I think something needs to... It just feels that this model is, in the current climate, is not working. And I think that maybe we need to be open to other things.
Okay, so do you actually done any data as well there?
No, I think that most of the data we're looking at now is to look at the fragilities that we see in the system. And actually, we've done studies here in the UK, particularly with the public sector, and looking at museums and the very difficult situation that most museums, I mean, we're not talking to national museums, we're talking to regional museums.
I know.
And even, I think this,
and even some of the national museums,
and even some of the national. But if the nationals are not doing that great, then the regionals are even worse. And I think this is it's a symptomatic again of a distribution of, I think, you know, the distribution of wealth in the art world at the moment is so sitting around so few artists.
Let's talk about this. You know, for the last year, what we were talking in art world is about the technology shift, as you said, the technology shift and the generational shift. So let's talk about the technology shift first. And then, you know, we talk about technology shift is because during the pandemic, people are using technology to sell. People are using technology to connect with people. So one big question, because before, I think before COVID 2019, we have so many art fairs that every month you either go for art fairs or biennial. It's, you don't need to go back to your home, to your home base. There's so many events happening. Of course, the with the art fair coming, I mean, with the pandemic, everything changes. Then one of the big questions we was talking about is whether this technology shift has actually impacted the art infrastructure, the art ecosystem. So up to now, we don't have an answer, a solution. We don't know. So according to your data, according to what you research, what are you seeing?
So I think you're absolutely right. I think prior to 2020, I think technology as overall, we're not talking only like online versus offline, we're talking about how technologies being adopted in the art world in general was, I would say, a very low adoption in generally. 2020 fast forward that evolution very quickly, out of necessity. I mean, we could, there was nothing else. I mean, you saw auction houses switching to online sales within,
but
you know,
remember,
hours.
During the pandemic, auction houses are making really good turnover. I'm just talking about art, right?
And I think this is, was a realization, which I think many people who were building these online companies or online platforms, whether it was Artsy and many others, were built often by technologies to say, well, this is a greater potential. We're here, we can reach out to more audiences, broader audiences, engage with new buyers, people who feel maybe intimidated by the traditional art world. I think the art world was holding back and saying, you know, this online thing is just something. And I remember I had a talk in 2016 where I presented the opportunities of online to a group of galleries in Barcelona at the time. And the hostility to change was palatable in the sense that no one wanted to change the idea.
No, because everybody is very set and,
exactly.
and is comfortable with that way.
And that, I think, is one of the kind of the key challenges that the art world have is the attitudes to change in general. And then that people are feeling
because
comfortable.
At that point, I remember that there were talks and we were all speaking about topics, whether art fair is still relevant. Because in that climate, you don't have art fair.
No.
I think the Hong Kong, I mean, the art bars of Hong Kong were still doing, but a lot of them were performing online. And that art fair was only for Hong Kong people because you are not, you could not travel in and into Hong Kong. And there was one big, you know, everybody was talking about the survival of art fairs. And then when everything is lifted, it's back to normal. The art fairs, art fairs, art fairs.
I think what's happened is that even if things have reverted to normal, I think, well, you can look at, again, looking at the auction data, you know, the online sales, even if they come down from 2021, which was the peak of the market, it's at 5-6 times the level that it used to be pre-pandemic. So everything has settled at slightly lower, but it's now much, much larger part than it used to be. So I think what's happening, I think the art world has sometimes this thing, this is kind of a binary, either is offline or online. Actually, online and offline works together. And I think we see that. We talk about online sales, but look at the way that the art world has embraced social media, using Instagram as a way of, you know, encouraging engagement, not necessarily buying, although more and more people are also using Instagram to directly, you know, engage
marketing.
With, marketing and also purchasing. So I think what we are experiencing right now is that I think online has been a leveler in terms of bringing in new audiences. It's been, for some people, the route of going into an art fair can be pretty intimidating. Yeah. A lot of people want to do research and even purchase online. And I think that hurdle that a lot of people had with regards to, no, you can't buy online without seeing it in physical form. I mean, you as a gallery is probably were sending collectors prior to online sales platform JPEGs about
do.
Work.
We always send. I've been doing PDF and JPEG for over 15 years.
There you go.
Yes, a long time. More than 15 years. My God, starting in the mid of 2000s, we were doing that.
Exactly. So there was already, I think, that barrier to buying things without seeing the artwork was already broken way before. I think there was
way
more.
Way before, especially when the art world becomes global.
Exactly.
You know, you want
exactly.
to sell to your clients overseas. What are you going
exactly.
to do?
Exactly. And but it was based on one particular aspect, which is trust. They yeah. were accepting to have an digital image of a work because they trusted you. And I think this is where the art world, where we saw a lot of the platforms that appeared in 2016 to 2020, early on before the pandemic, struggled to gain trust because they didn't have the brand name. So, you know, the likes of, I mean, you know, Sotheby's and Christie's have 300 years of history, which means that even if they sell things online, there's a brand that stands behind it, which has some certain integrity. And the same thing with galleries. I think it was more the fact that the galleries were reluctant to adopt this. There was a sort of hesitancy in terms of how do we present, how do we sell? And that's still with this conversation I had last week with some galleries saying that we don't want to put pricing online because it makes things too transparent.
We don't want to put pricing and online. But to some, even with the PDF, we usually don't put pricing. But nowadays, because of some of the clients that we know, we do put pricing. And yeah. if you see some of the major galleries yeah. before art fair, when they send presentation, now they all put prices on all the artworks.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that the format has been changing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's evolving to certain ways. But however, the question I'm giving you is, do you think that art fairs is still relevant? With all these technology shift, and then there's so many art fairs yeah. going on.
I think the art fair model is still relevant, but I think it maybe become too dominant. I think the online will always. I think it's a. I see on the online the technology and art fairs as omni-channel. Kind of, you know, you engage with the art world in different ways. I think there may be some of the problems, as you mentioned, with regards to people traveling into Art Basel in Paris to see what's happening there, is that the fair becomes the focus. And many of the other things that's happening around the fair, that's kind of not really, you know, people don't have the time to see all the kind of other engagements that are taking place. And I think it's the kind of, as much as the fair has been an amazing, I think a way to, first of all, counter some of the competition that the auction houses were creating in the sort of latter part of this, or 2010 onwards, by moving into contemporary, by moving into different, you're becoming a sort of a hybrid between auction and dealer and advisor, all these things meant that I think the primary sector needed to find a way to come together to present a counter to the power of the auction market. I think that model became very powerful and very useful at that point, but has come to a point where it's almost it's kind of now, it feels like it's restricting the market. I don't say it should go away. I just think that there needs to be an alternative, maybe not in the same setting. So that means that maybe there are, I mean, I guess already we're starting to see consolidation in fairs. We're starting to see more fairs being acquired by others and so forth.
Yes,
so I think that
yes,
landscape.
Because is all, the office is getting bigger yeah, and bigger yeah. and bigger.
But it is an important platform, I do think, to bring people in.
Because art fair now becomes a social event.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And actually, it brings whatever city for the art fair, it brings a lot of tourism as well. And of course, there are all the satellite exhibitions all around.
Exactly.
Right. So we're talking about the importance of culture now.
Mm, yeah.
The culture, I think, you know, I mean, this past decades, culture becomes a very important element mm-hmm. and ties a whole population mm-hmm. to make visits, to understand. I hope that, you know, we will have more cultural fluency between different countries. Okay, let's talk about this correlation. for 300 years, stock market and art market, they are correlated.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's completely broken.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I mean, this has become a huge topic among the art world.
Mm.
So give me your comments about it.
Yeah, I think obviously the art world, if you're starting to think about it in the perspective of 300 years, is even if you took the last 25 years, which we've been studying, it's a very, very different dynamic from even what we saw in the 90s or 80s. So everything has changed.
Oh, completely different 80s and 90s.
Completely.
And the art market just expanded and in the 21st century, especially for contemporary
exactly.
art.
Exactly. And I think it's also in that regard, the nature of art, if you think about it, an asset, a cultural object, but with financial characteristics associated with it. The art world or the art market and the other asset classes that exist there. I mean, there's interesting, there's a lot of studies, obviously, regarding correlation. So this, you know, this relationship between different asset classes. And I think, you know, generally, the art market has been relatively immune to many of the things that we've seen in the world, although it typically happens with a lag. So it takes a bit of time for the art world to react to major events. And I think that partly, you know, it's a little bit down to the system is much slower. This is not a market that can just, on the push of a button, change.
But usually when a stock market goes up,
yeah.
the art market becomes very vibrant.
Yeah.
But today, the stock market is going up, 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 up. Art market is down, 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 down.
Yeah.
So...
I think there's a slight there's become again almost like since 2022 2023 a disconnect between so you could obviously on that basis say these two markets are uncorrelated because we've, you know, wealth and stock markets going one way and the art market goes the other. From a diversification point of view, you could say, well, that's maybe a good thing. I think the problem obviously is that the wealth that's been created, and that's actually not a new thing. We have seen this now over almost 16, 17 years, wealth has been growing exponentially and the art world and the art market has remained flat. Nothing has changed. So if you took a 2008 and compared that with 2024, we are at the same level. So then it's the question, where's that all that money going? Why isn't it engaging into art? And I think this comes a little bit back to what we discussed earlier, that we are stuck in a model that doesn't really about expanding the market. Prices has got higher and higher and higher, which I think is a problem in itself, because higher prices means also fewer audiences that can engage at these price levels. So there's been a sort of perpetuating, even the focus of media regarding when they report on something is always the, you know, multi-million transactions that are taking place, which reinforces the kind of thing that is this market is completely out of reach for most people. The market itself as a pie, the pie hasn't really changed its size. It's the same. It's just been split differently. So the parts of the market, the 100 artists, that the top 100 artists in the world will just account for more and more of that wealth. The same artist will be represented by a few roster of galleries, which will become wealthier and wealthier. But it doesn't trickle. Some of that wealth that's created doesn't go down further in this ecosystem, whether that's to the public sector or smaller galleries. And right. I think there's a sort of ultimately a problem in this art world right now, which is not unique to the art world, but to the society at large, is that how do we ensure that we get a balanced ecosystem where the grassroots initiatives can be supported, because ultimately if we go 20, 30 years into the future, if we don't support these, the next generation of talents is not going to come through. And that, yeah, so I there's this almost like a systemic problem in the art world right now, which I think needs to be somehow addressed and solved.
I have been, during our discussion with the different people in the art world, I first see a question whether the stock market is truly reflecting the economy of the country.
Yeah.
That's number one thing I was talking about. Number two is, yes, we have this huge problem about art market, because to the extent that there's some major galleries closing down,
mm-hmm.
and because we don't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm.
What do you see it? Because we can't see it.
Yeah.
And that is why everybody is, we can't even plan the next step.
Yeah.
You see galleries, we have less and less exhibitions.
Mm.
Artists, big name artists are saying that, well, the market is so bad. If you can't sell my painting, why should I do an exhibition? So in generally, there is really a very, very down feeling of the art market.
Yeah, no, I've been feeling this, or getting that sentiment now for several years. I do think we might be at a kind of a turning point, and in a sense that I think...
I was told that 2026 will be even worse.
You were saying that.
Yeah, that's what, last few days I was talking with people. I said, worse than 2025?
Yeah.
No, that's what people is talking about.
Yeah,
in the art market. My God,
the turning point might not be sort of imminent.
I don't think so.
I just feel like the sliding in the market. We've sort of been on a kind of constant. Everything has become negative and is falling.
Because people now are saying that now is worse than 2008, because 2008 was very, very. It was like a transition period. Yeah. As soon as China entered the market, everything changes. Yeah. Everything goes up, 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 up. Mm. But now we don't have there's nothing that incites and trigger the market to jump.
No. And I think maybe this is a little bit a reflection of the mood in the society at large. And I think it's hard to find positives, right? It's hard to...
We have a very unstable political situation all over the world. And of course...
And it's hard to find, I think, almost carve out a purpose for, I guess, particularly consumption of art in a world which is so, filled with so much uncertainty. And I think this is... it's a problem. And I think, obviously... even maybe some things looks like it's maybe stabilizing it. I think, still there's so many issues out there. So there's that needs to change in order for, I think, to bring more energy back into the market. What makes me positive is that I see grassroots energy, like where there's no commercial, we're not talking about the commercial market, but artists doing interesting things, smaller galleries, collaborative efforts between, which doesn't feature in any kind of, never hit a media headline, but there are a willingness to, I think, among a generation now, particularly younger generation, to do something different.
But the younger generation, we would, there's many of these information coming out, is Generation Z, Generation Z, they like experiences.
Yeah.
So especially, I'm applying this to Northern America and Western Europe, that if they inherit a whole collection, they're going to sell it.
Yeah.
So they don't want to have that responsibility to look after the collection.
Yeah.
And also... They don't want to read. They have this short attention span. Conceptual art is not what they want. They have so short. They want to have something that they either like or they don't like. They set their own taste. So what is going to happen with the gender? So I've been always talking about, that's applied to Northern America, Western Europe, but also believe that there is a geographical shift.
Definitely.
Because, when I talk to younger people in Asia, I just met someone who's in the late 20s, 29 now, and who recently make a huge profit because they sold a company. I don't even want to talk about the numbers. The numbers is more than what? Is nine-digit numbers. What they want is they want to build collections. So I'm seeing Asia and Middle East would be start ticking over the importance of building collections as in America and in Europe.
It's going to be very interesting to see what art that we see today will transcend from the boomers down to the Gen X's or the millennials and Gen Z's. And I think you're right. We are in the stage where taste is changing. You mentioned experience. Other words that
typically... they want experience. They want to travel. They want to have experience. They don't want to be tied down by looking after a collection.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, why immersive exhibition?
Yeah.
I mean, it's full. Tim Lab is just full. Because of this connection.
Yeah.
Now, I went to Jeddah. I went to Tim Lab.
Mm-hmm.
No one was there.
Mm.
No one.
Mm. I haven't actually kind of specifically looked at that aspect, but I do think I mean, some of the interesting things just in that generational shift that we are looking at, what I think is interesting is that a lot of people talking about, you know, the great wealth transfer.
Yeah.
And everyone just assumes that money is going to flow downwards to the next generation. But actually, statistically, the money is going to flow typically sidewards. So it'll go to, well, in the case if it's the man who's got the money, then we'll go to the women. But so there's also an increasing focus, I think, on the women will be the one that now is going to be in power in terms of wealth, which will also, I think, drive the way that the art market might move going forward in terms of a different, maybe aesthetics, but also a different way of thinking about supporting art. And we see this already in philanthropy, where some people build massive buildings and put their names on it. Others are supporting, you know, I would say we did an interesting study in South Asia looking at the Indian philanthropy landscape. Most of them are actually women. Very dynamic, but also supporting a very diverse set of initiatives, not only built in one, but supporting artist residents, supporting biennials. So there, I think this shift, not only younger generation, but that the shift sidewards first will also have an impact on how the art world will go forward. Now, we did a study with Sotheby's looking at surrealism just recently. Yeah. We just published a report. And it's actually very interesting to see how in the last, since 2020, how millennials and Gen Zs are becoming almost a 30% of the bidder pool in surrealist art, and predominantly actually 20th century. And this is, I think, also linked to, as much as we think people might go into the experiences and starting to go that, there is also a desire to revisit history, and particularly women history, you know, women artist history, to look at the likes of Leonora Carrington and Dorothea Tanning and some of the others. A lot of that is actually pushed by a younger generation of collectors that are trying to rectify some of the things that's in the past. So I also, as much as we are struggling with this, you know, will people, this thing of ownership is, I think, something which young people not necessarily don't want to own things.
They don't want to. I'm not talking millennials. Millennials still want to own things. I'm talking about Gen Z.
Gen Z.
But
do you think it's maybe they are so young in their development that they haven't yet come
no,
to...
No, I don't think so. I think that, I mean, I'm talking to these young people whose parents are great collectors who have a great collection.
Yeah.
They don't want to have this responsibility to raise that. When they get older, when they inherit, they don't want to.
Yeah.
They want to be free. And also what the parents collect may not be what they want.
Yeah.
They want very simple things, much simpler.
Mm.
You know, we love conceptual art. We want to see through the artists to talk about politics, social urbanization, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And the younger people, they just want to see things that makes them happy or not happy. I mean, see what they purchase. See that their consumerism behavior is very, very different from us.
No, exactly.
Yeah, and even when I think that, you know, how would the brands survive? Because they don't have that urge. I mean, they're not inspired to buy brands or labels. So it's completely different. Yeah. So I don't know how the future market is going to be adapted.
No.
But for me, it's all about culture because, you know, buying or not buying is not, I mean, it's all about culture.
Mm.
But the problem today is even the museums have much less visitors because the Gen Z doesn't like what the museum are showing.
Mm.
I mean, there are certain artists they like because they like artists who are more accessible.
Mm. Yeah.
That they can look at it, whether they like it or not liking it.
Yeah.
And that brought in a lot of younger audiences, visitors.
Mm. I mean, we're facing so many different shifts and challenges. And one of those is that generational shift, which has consequences for private collections, public collections, how we think about presentational culture. I do hope that there is something if not on a consumer, on the ownership level, but that art, and I still believe, particularly in today's society, that art plays a more profound role than the consumerist.
All I see is museums are changing. I mean, like National Gallery, they have contemporary art.
Yeah.
And all that, I think, is the way that you bring a younger generation. With them looking at contemporary art, maybe they would appreciate the historical that evolved until today.
Definitely. But also, I think the fundamental problem why maybe this is not happening, or maybe not happening to the extent, is that most of these institutions just also are lacking the funding to activate. So there's a kind of an underlying problem why maybe the sector cannot meet the expectations, is that the money just isn't there. And that, I think, you know, we talked about before, is museums, I think, are, you know, that is the educational, that this is where people experience it. I mean, in this country, when you start to cut out art from the curriculum and focusing on STEM projects, all these things are affecting a generation of, when we're talking about Gen Z, if they're not interested, well, there's a reason why they're not interested, because it's not taught.
I mean, I forgot, that's a fundamental thing. Yeah. Okay, so also explain to me why luxury collectibles, watches, jewelries, for the past 2-3 years, it just increased. Yeah. 68%, the market just increased. Mm. Is there a reason?
I think the market is more, it has aspects to it which is easier to understand than art, I think.
I mean, I don't see people as wearing it. It's so dangerous
now.
Yeah. In London, walking around with jewelries and expensive watches. But why would the market, you know, why would just went up?
I think the luxury goods sector has maybe a couple of things that the art market has. First of all, I think there's a certain transparency in terms of pricing and value. So it's very obvious. I think also the brands themselves.
Do you think it is an investment?
I think collectibles in general are, you know, as long as people desire them, there will be an investment. Yeah.
When we look at the synthetic diamonds, since the synthetic diamonds came into the market, the diamond cartel completely collapsed. So it's very surprising that the jewelry's market went up. And then how about old master?
The old master
market is also resurrected. Went up.
I mean, the old master market's interesting because I do think it's obviously relative value compared to other art, you know, other genres is cheaper.
Yeah, much lower the price.
And you're looking at, you know, something which has a long history. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of storytelling. I think there's an attraction to, I think aesthetically, some people might find it difficult, or connoisseurship even, that you need. This is not simply
very hard.
It's hard. Authenticity, attribution, all those things. But from an historic point of view, I think, you know, these are artworks that, in relative terms to many other parts of the market, is now being considered very affordable. And I think that is maybe part of it. Now, obviously, the art market, when you're looking from the data, is that it's very hard to track the old master market properly, because you will have two Botticellis that suddenly appears in the market and they sell for, you know, 30 millions. And that was the whole, majority. Exactly. So, but I think it's interesting. I mean, this is, the old master market, I think, is interesting in the sense that it is potentially one of the markets that could offer that next generation something really interesting in terms of stories and storytelling. The problem, I think, is for the sector to communicate that to that next audience. And I think, you know, it's finding the next generation of collectors of old masters. It's interesting that you see some, you know, within the gallery sectors of old masters, that there is next generation coming in, thinking about contemporary art in relationship to old masters. So you're starting to see more, you know, exhibitions where old masters are juxtaposed with contemporary art, and there's a dialogue between them. I think this is a way of bridging, you know, finding the conversation.
That's how they display in National Gallery.
Yeah.
It was really interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I mean, this is where I think sometimes when you look at the art market, you're getting the optics of the market suggest that we are in a really, really bad place. I do think when you're starting to, and I don't know, maybe from a gallery's perspective, you're looking at this differently, but when you look at what is happening if you peel away the 1 million plus, so you're taking away all the high end of the market and starting to look at, you know, individual segments. I mean, for example, I had a conversation last week with someone who operates in the print market, and it's very active. So limited editions. You see platforms like AvantArt, for example, has been very successful in engaging new buyers in artists that are well known, but people felt that there's no way we can access this market. But through a what they call these, it's a fixed price, but the limit, the edition size is left open depending on demand. There are models out there that's been experimented with, which I think is this thing of providing access and coming back to luxury goods. Why has that market done well? And I think one of the things that's, and is not to compare luxury goods with fine art, but the model of providing multiple access points. You know, you can come in at $150 handbag, you can come in at $5,000, you can come in at $50,000. Allows different buyer groups, the new buyer, to engage with the brand on a relatively affordable level. And then you can, as you know, if you want to decide, you can go up. And I think this is where the art market had an opportunity, always had an opportunity in the beginning, to kind of focus that there are multiple ways of buying into an artist. You can do it through the original series, but you can also do it through the print series and the limited editions. There's a stigma a little bit around the limited edition, as these were sort of secondary. And I remember most galleries would put the limited editions in the kind of book place where you sold catalogs, etc. I think it's been kind of deprioritized, but it's coming back again. As I said, AvantArt, I think, has done a great job in engaging people actually outside the art world into this world of being ownership.
Exactly. It's easier for them to access a lower price when they want to have something, at least as the first point.
Exactly, as a starting point.
Yeah, as a starting point of acquiring. Okay, last question I want to ask. I want to get your comment. Recent news, huge news in the heart. Everybody's talking about it. David Werner, House & Worth, this year they only made 10% of last year's profit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's
shocking. We are all shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked not because of how much you made. Shocking is they admitted.
Yeah.
Because all art. We all know that whenever you go to art fairs, everybody will ask, oh, what do you sell? Everybody says, oh, it's splendid. We sold very well.
Mm.
No one has been so honest about
it. Yeah, no, I mean, I think this is probably, again, a symptom of all the things we talked about already, that, you know, the market has contracted. I think, you know, sales and prices are under pressure. At the same time that the art world is left for the same infrastructure that they had in 2021 when the market was at its peak. And so you're left with a cost structure that is exactly the same and maybe even higher, because prices of, as you mentioned, fares, transport, fares, shipping.
After COVID, after the pandemic, the shipping costs went sky high.
Yeah. So you have to still play by the same rule book as you did in 2021 with the same cost base, but then lower sales, which obviously translates into lower
because
profits.
Because logistic today has gone haywire.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they still make profits, I think, is, you know, even if it's, you know, much less than it used to, that still means that there's at least, you know, they're making money somehow, but probably not to the same extent. And I think This is, I guess, the reality in the current market. But I do think, as much as if it hits that level of galleries that hard, how hard will it then hit other galleries further down?
It's small galleries.
Exactly.
How could they survive?
And that's, I think, it's a real question. I think that's coming back to the point that we are almost in sort of an existential period where something has to break. It's not sustainable to maintain the same thing. I mean, you mentioned art. Yeah. How many art fairs did you used to do?
Oh, God, 12, 13.
And now?
Yeah, now, this year, 3. I just done one.
Yeah.
2 is next month, which I... Yeah. Mm.
And I guess that decision was based on the same thing. So I think, you know, this is where maybe new thinking... the call for new ways of doing things might be. But it's hard because obviously when you don't have that energy in the market, you don't have the...
How many young galleries... Do you know, when you do research, do you know how many young galleries survive?
We haven't done that research. There are, I think someone has actually done that. I can't remember who did that a few years ago. So I wouldn't have any statistics on it. But I think, you know, that this is a little bit also, like I guess any business, the first 2-3 years of your business is the most vulnerable if you can get past that. And I think this is, again, one of the challenges is that these young galleries are still aspiring to the same trajectory as your generation of galleries were doing, in the sense of, in the way to kind of reach the upper echelon of the art market, you will have to follow the certain path of going through certain fairs, having certain, you know, venues in certain locations, etc. And I think that is unsustainable, or very difficult for these galleries to kind of even get into that.
Through, yeah.
So what is the alternative? Where do they go?
Because when we go to art fairs, because you meet new clients, that's what you go to the art fairs. And with a younger gallery, the exposure is low.
Yeah.
So they definitely need art fairs and or pay a lot in promotions.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, if you are a gallery operating at a certain price level, you could probably... hopefully cover the cost of a fair, but if you're dealing with artists, you know, artwork in much lower,
artwork of low price cannot go to these really expensive art fairs. No. It doesn't even cover the logistic cost.
There you see.
Yeah.
And I think this is a problem because that also means that the audiences that are going to these fairs, because they are still an important hub for, you know, social meeting, networking, but also buying, is that if the galleries are not going to be present in these fairs, how do we discover their artist? How do we find their artist?
Absolutely. But most of the people, when they buy art today, when they collect art, they don't buy because they like it or out of fashion, especially today.
Mm.
It's all about preserving the value of your money. Mm. It's about money. It's about investment.
Yeah. And I think this is...
They don't want to take risk.
And this is a little bit, I guess, it's sort of the narrative around art ownership I can see this even the 25 years we've been doing this, how it's changed from collectibles to more an asset, financial.
Yeah, because art collection traditionally is only for the elite.
Mm.
Since in the 21st century, it becomes democratized. Mm. When it democratized, surely enough, it will turn into an asset.
Mm.
So... Yep. Everything changes.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything's thing is adapted to that.
And I think that's also, you know, one of the reasons why we're feeling maybe quite gloomy right now. If you turn things into an asset and, you know, it will follow the nature of an asset, that in a sense, when a value then starts to evaporate out of that, so the interest will be lost. And if there is no strong, strong emotional connection with these, then... they are just going to be treated as anything else. People will sell, people will get rid of it.
Oh, don't you feel that today is all about that? It's very funny. Yesterday, we were talking about emotional value.
Mm.
But the emotional value is buying, you know, these popular things. We were talking about, you know, La Boubou, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about it a lot. And yesterday, how from Pop Mart to these... to Hermes, how they can create this emotional value on these goods.
Yeah.
Certain artwork comes to a certain prices.
Yeah.
The high price range. Your emotional value would be subsided and to be overtaken by investment value.
Yeah, and I think that there's always a point, I think, you know, when you think about the price and value of art, is that way it turns from a collectible into something more. Yeah. And obviously that's where, you know, as much as people think about financialization of art regarding investing in art, there's also a whole financial system around, you know, art secured lending, where there's value, there's also financial services. I don't think this is, I mean, the problem, I mean, I think the financialization in terms of, it is inevitable that will happen. I think the problem is
we can't avoid it because it's already happened.
And I think that I do think even in the investment space, you know, some people are thinking, and I think particularly since the pandemic, there was a period of 2-3 years where everything was heavily speculative. Everything was going up. People were making money about flipping and selling. I think if you start to, as much as, you know, there's this tension between collecting and investment, but I do think there is also an overlap. And if you look at the statistics and looking at the numbers, if you look at the average holding period, typically what happens is if you hold art less than 10 years, there's a 50-50 chance that you will actually have a positive return on that thing. If you move beyond 10 years, you are moving into 70% chance that it will have a higher value. And it's the interesting thing, when we look at data over the last 3-4 years across thousands of what we call repeat sales, is that the average holding period is around 20 years. Now, 20 years is almost the same as a collector thinking about this journey.
I always tell my client, and if they want to come, I want to make this. I said, usually if you want to make, several times, you sit on it.
Exactly.
I mean, I know collectors sat on it for 30 years. Part of it would even becomes nothing.
Yeah.
Only several paintings goes up 100 times.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's a mix of, obviously, then that will not have happened if you were a pure investor.
But the thing is, when you start acquiring art, you have to set up, are you collecting it because you want to build a collection? Are you collecting it because you want to be, it is an investment asset? Mm. So the buying is completely different.
Completely.
Completely different.
And I think that thing that you mentioned, the it is trying to change people. You can have a financial interest, you know, that the financial value has for many people an importance. And I don't think that necessarily needs to be counter to the emotional and the kind of interest in the object. I think you can, a lot of the discussions we have now around wealth and art and succession planning, etc., is to start to think about if you're buying and investing in art with a 20-year perspective, you can start to think about generational shifts of art. You involve your children from a very early age, and you start to think about the collection not necessarily only as a personal thing, but as a family endeavor. And I think there are interesting collectors that are involving their children at an early age. They might evolve their taste later on. I'm not saying they're going to collect exactly the same as their parents.
No, they would evolve anyway.
They will. Yeah.
They will. It's just like, I have some of my friends, would they keep the old master? Of course not. Immediately when they inherit, they sold it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
At this point, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.